Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack. Welcome to Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack, and I thank you all for joining me. After some time spent in Maine this summer, I was missing it so much that I really needed to revisit an absolutely glorious book called Fellowship Point by today's guest, the incredible Alice Elliott Dark. Now, many of you know that Alice Elliott Dark is the author of a novel called Think of England, as well as two fantastic collections of short stories, In the Gloaming and Naked to the Waist. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, The New York Times, and Best American Short Stories, among so many others. Her award-winning story, In the Gloaming, was made into two films and was chosen for inclusion in Best American Stories of the Century. Alice Elliott Dark is a past recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship and is currently an associate professor at Rutgers Newark in the MFA program. Sign me up for that class to watch a master at work. And having said all of that, Alice Elliott Dark, thank you so much for joining me and the listeners of Merrick Library's Top Shelf podcast. I am so honored that you're here.
Thank you so much. I am so thrilled to be here.
This is an amazing thing that you're here. We cannot keep your book on our shelves at Merrick Library. And I mean it. It's like a national bestseller, as you know. There's even clamoring for all of your back titles, which I'm thrilled. Wow. Amazing, amazing. I have two of my own copies that I haven't seen in months because they just keep getting lent out to all of my friends and relatives. Time magazine calls Fellowship Point an utterly engrossing and sweeping work. But my favorite quote is from author Andrea Lee, and she says Fellowship Point is an instant classic, an epic tale of love, family, friendship, literature, and the American landscape. Obviously, I'm here with my effusive gushing, and good heavens, I will try to keep myself in check. But thank you again for being here. If you would, tell listeners and patrons of Merrick Library's Top Shelf podcast about Fellowship Point.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. I am totally blushing. It's hard to listen to, but very, very nice. So thank you. Fellowship Point is a book about primarily about three women. Two are 80 years old, and they've been lifelong best friends. And then a 26-year-old assistant editor at a publishing company who enters the lives of the older women and changes them substantially. It takes place primarily 2000 to 2002. There's a backstory as well. So we see Agnes and Polly, the best friends, when they're younger, but mostly 2000 to 2002, and mostly in Maine. They live on a beautiful piece of land called Fellowship Point that Agnes's great-great-great-grandfather founded in the 1870s as a fellowship of five Quaker families. And the central plot of the book has to do with what's going to happen to the land after this generation dies. There's a fellowship agreement, which I won't go into the whole thing, but there has to be a consensus to break it and to give the land away. And that's what Agnes is after. She's trying to convince two other of the landowners to break the agreement so they can give the land to a land trust. So that's primarily the big picture of the book.
What you have created here in Fellowship Point, I don't have the words for, which is probably not a good look for a podcaster, but... But here we are. The book, as Andrea Lee says, instant classic, it has a feel like a classic 19th century novel. It has a beautifully woven and multi-layered narrative. But with this magic, the magic of your prose, the themes of the book are nearly, it's entirely 21st century, right? So there's this deep and empathic interest in the exploration of women's lives. Gender issues that you put in here so beautifully, class differences, the struggle to protect the environment, as you said, This book has everything and then some. When I put the book down, I rushed back to the beginning to start reading it again because I just wanted to see how the heck did I get here from page one? I needed to go back and look at that first chapter. What is your inspiration for this book? Did you have Agnes come first? Was Polly first? What tickled you to say, okay, I'm going to write this opus?
Well, the character that actually came first was Virgil, and he is not a major character in the final version of the book, but he came first, and I wrote a few hundred pages about him, and he led me to Maine, and then once we were in Maine, Polly appeared, and Robert appeared, and then Agnes appeared, and once I had all of them together, I knew there was something brewing, but I wasn't sure exactly what it was, and I did have the idea that I wanted to write a 19th century novel, but with women owning the land instead of men owning the land. There wasn't a 19th century novel where women were the landowners, and it was their big issue in the book. And I thought that would be an interesting twist to explore how women possibly would think about the fate of their land compared to a lot of the history that we know without saying of how these things go. And also to play with that form, which I love so much. I love those big books with big plots and subplots and all kinds of things going on. What sent me into it this time was I watched a miniseries on TV called He Knew He Was Right by Anthony Trollope. It was based on that book, which it's a title that sounds like such a modern title, doesn't it? I mean, it's hard to believe it's one of those novels. But then I thought this is so fun, you know, so twisty and interesting. And so I went back and read the novel, and I read a couple of others of his novels. Like, his output was extraordinary.
Sure.
And they're all like, you know, they're all really gripping, twisty plots and so on. And I so admired it. I was like, I have to learn how to do this. And of course, I had other favorite 19th century novels even before I came upon that one. I love Middlemarch. I love all of George Eliot, actually, and all the biggies. And of course, back to Madame Bovary and then Jane Eyre. Those books are still touchstones for me, and I reread and reread and reread. They're probably just in my writing DNA pretty deeply by this point.
I love that you're saying you decided to just learn how to do this. Okay. I can learn how to make a recipe. I can learn how to make meatballs or something like that. But to learn how to do this, what you did in Fellowship Point, I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. I don't know how long it takes you to get into the voice. I don't know how long it takes. To me, it's just magic. It's just magic for me.
I was very lucky because these characters came to me so fully formed. And I really just had to set them loose. It took a while to figure out what the plot was going to be and to create Fellowship Point itself and all of those things. But I was guided by the characters the whole time. For example, when I was creating the place, I had Agnes and Polly. Well, they're best friends since they were babies. They were born in the same year. So I said, I'll have them live next to each other. I'll put their houses next to each other, because that's sort of a fantasy, like always have your house next to your best friend, whole life. So that kind of thing, it's like their relationship led me into some of the setting situations, and also that then they were Quakers, so they needed to have a meeting place and there needed to be a graveyard on the point. And they just led me through. In terms of learning the form, thank you for saying it was a big thing to do, because it was for me. I started out as a poet. I was a poet until I was 30. And honestly, if someone had ever told me you're going to end up writing a book like this, I would have just laughed. Like, I couldn't get off of one page for 15 years. So, but I really thought I had the sense, and I turned out to be right, that it would be a very fun project to figure out how to do this. And it wasn't that easy for me. These things don't come to me as easily as they do to some people, like aspects of narration. I have to really think about it, write about it, throw pages out and so on. But I stuck with it. And then I did. It started to become more and more fun. You know, it started out as like as if you walked into a barn full of 200 years worth of junk and you're trying to sort it out. But it ended up being a nice little pretty puzzle at the very end where I was just snapping pieces into place.
pretty puzzle. I love that description. It's a beautiful tapestry. So your pretty puzzle turned into this beautiful tapestry. I said at the top I was going to wax rhapsodic. So that I'm telling the truth. Like some classic novels, you have a map, right? This map of Cape Deal is fantastic. It put me right on the point, so to speak. As you're describing the movements of the characters, I was going back and forth. I had a little sticky on the map so I could flip back and forth. I was where they were. It just made Fellowship Point so much more immersive and satisfying for me. It's very interesting for me to hear that Virgil was your first knock on the door. That I want to say it's shocking to me because I would never have imagined that.
I know.
I actually would have thought it would have been Agnes, to be honest.
I know. It does seem that way. But that happens. You don't always get the central character first. I wrote a whole draft of the book that was Polly and Robert. It was Robert comes out of prison and Polly invites him to live at her house.
Right.
And it was just the two of them getting to know each other as they never had. And I really enjoyed it, but it wasn't the book I wanted to write this big book. And that was a step. But once Agnes really started talking, and once she had this big goal of saving the point, she took over the book. She's really the main character. She's not only trying to save the point, she also has a book she's trying to write before it becomes too late. She's racing against the clock a little bit because she has a cancer recurrence, which is really a minor piece of the story, mainly because her attitude puts it in that position in her life. But she does have a lot of challenges going on in her life. And I was so fascinated how she meets the challenges and is so vital and, well, you know, a little bit crusty, not the easiest. I think it would be terrifying if she didn't like you.
Yeah. I certainly got that. Yeah.
If she likes you, she's very loyal and she tries to help people and she has a very good heart. She's not exactly involved in any kind of a family life after she loses her own family. And she has her days are under her control. She can write on her schedule, meals are made for her and so on. So she has this position of freedom. I was thinking of it as, what do you do if your basic needs are satisfied? And see what someone would do with that. Because I really think people who have a lot of good fortune, privilege, they should be doing better. Yeah. It's like, okay, you don't even have to worry about dinner. So what are you going to do with that? That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So I kind of set those challenges for them. How are they going to exercise the level of good fortune that they have had in their lives? And I do think of it as good fortune. They just happen to be born into this situation, which is very enviable. But they have their problems too, of course. Everybody does.
Everybody does. And I appreciate the dives into those problems for both Agnes, Polly, and Maud. We didn't even get to Maud, but it's amazing their relationship, Agnes and Polly, they have this decades-long friendship. You put the reader right on their shoulders. We watch them grow and change and become these incredible women. It's wonderful watching them transform and become these strong women, their rich histories that you've given us. I heard or read somewhere that the book was close to 800 pages, which I would have read every single one. I'm just telling you right now.
A lot of people have said that to me.
Every single
one. Where's the rest? Where's more?
Was there anything that you, obviously you had to cut some things out. Was there anything that you had to cut that you wanted to leave in? Like I said, I wanted more from them. So I wasn't ready to leave Fellowship Point. Obviously, I'd like to go back. But was there something that you had to cut that you didn't want to cut?
I think the only thing that I really liked that I cut, I mean, I liked everything that I cut, but the one that I felt slightly ambivalent about was I had the first chapter, them when they were 14. And it's when they first see young Ham Luce come onto the property and he shoots an owl, and they are so horrified. They make a blood pack, you know, a finger stick pack to protect the point above all else, above all commitments in their lives. And it was very fun for me to write about them when they were 14 and watch them waking up in the morning in those houses and going out by themselves and just having a lot of the freedom. It is described in the book what it was like for those children when they were young, but it was fun to have it. I didn't think it was a bad idea to cut it. I just felt a little twang letting it go.
Yeah.
The other main parts that I cut were, I had a chapter from four male points of view, like the four central men in the book. Well, the three main men, and then also one of Polly's children, Theo, the youngest child. They each had their say a little more than they do. I went back and rewrote it so that all of the things I had put in those chapters are actually still in the book, but they're from the other points, from the women's point of view. So it's not lost. It's very compressed. Mm-hmm. And Virgil, I had 150 pages in the book, and it's like one paragraph. Really, it was just compressed so intensely.
You mentioned Polly and Agnes as teens, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, there are quite a few scenes where you talk about these family legacies growing up at the lake and grabbing their clothes and running down to the water and hiking and doing all these things together. Beautiful, beautiful. It felt big. Mm-hmm. Even if it's compressed, it felt big. There was a scope there that I think the reader relates to. And maybe that's what people are reacting to. You know, oh gosh, you know, we want to know what those two are up to, especially those two, because my goodness.
I know. You know, I ended up thinking that cutting a lot of the things and compressing them made the book have a very chewy texture. It does feel rich. It doesn't feel thin. And possibly because I did a lot of writing that doesn't appear, but it's still there. Its spirits around the book are still there.
Subtext is there for sure. I mean, it really does come across in living color. So I've spent the past 36 summers in Maine. Talk about Maine a little bit.
I go to Maine every summer, and I spend a lot of time there in all seasons. My mother had a house there until a few years ago, and I went to camp there for years, and it's just very, very familiar terrain to me. And I think Maine is different than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. It has its own topography. It has its own people, the way they speak. Everything is just very particular to Maine. And I really felt that it would be the right setting for these characters, because there's a Yankee-ness to it that is the same as it is for these women. Even though they're from Philadelphia, they aren't Yankees, but there's a continuum, I would say, between these Quaker Philadelphians and the sort of Yankee-ness of Maine. And it's a feeling of being stalwart and no self-pity and rising to the occasion, all of those old-fashioned words we don't even hear anymore. But the landscape of Maine is just a perfect complement to the attitudes of these people.
I know that it took a long time to write Fellowship Point. And I also am a huge fan of short stories. I was aware of In the Gloaming. I knew all about it. Did any part of Fellowship Point start as a short story?
Not really. Okay. I did think of, especially those chapters that I cut from the men, they aren't short stories, but they could be reworked as short stories. I'm actually writing right now a book that has it's a sequel to In the Gloaming, more or less. It has a lot of, it's really about the sister. When I first wrote the story, she was the protagonist, and I changed it to the mother. So she only has a walk-on in the story, but I've been writing about her, thinking about her. So that's a little more, was a series of stories that I was working on, but now it's just being made into a legit novel.
Okay, that's unbelievable. And I do want to go back to In the Gloaming based on everything we just said, because it was included in the best short stories of the century. It did have two screen treatments, which tells us everything about how important and incredible it is. When I reread the story recently, there's a conversation between Laird and his mother. And that conversation reminded me so much of Polly. I know we spent a lot of time talking about Agnes because she wouldn't have it any other way, probably.
I love that.
there's a conversation between Laird and his mom. And Laird says, I want to get to know you. And his mother says, oh, Laird, there's nothing to know. And he says, I don't believe that for a minute. And she says, but it's true. I'm average. The only extraordinary thing about me is my children. And that piece, oh, I'm getting the chills. That piece really reminded me so much of Polly because of everything. There's so many things about Polly that are in that little piece. Talk about writing Polly. She's so different than Agnes, but I loved her every bit as much as I loved Agnes.
Thank you for saying that. I feel the same way. I love Polly. Some people tell me she's their favorite character, which makes me happy because she's someone who could easily be judged and overlooked and thought of as being a doormat. People have said that to me who don't love her, but that means they haven't read the whole book.
Right.
Then I know, okay, you didn't finish the book.
Right. Yes.
Because you can't come away at the end thinking that about her. But I really, and it's interesting you compare it to Janet and the Gloaming because they really come from my same perception of people in my mother's and grandmother's generation that I was looking at when I was a child and feeling that they were very undervalued people, that they were making the world beautiful for everyone. They were keeping track of the birthdays and the family structure and the social structure, all of those things. Which I really appreciate. I've always worked. So my friends who are housewives, if you want to put it in those terms, I really appreciate that they pick up a lot of slack for making things really lovely. And also, that's just part of it. But the other part of it is, I just saw so many women deal with seriously very difficult issues like this in The Gloaming with the son dying. And also Polly has a child who dies. And just do it with so much grace and fortitude and understanding the larger aspects of life. These things are terrible, but life does go on. You have to find a way to live with tragedy. And I did see that all around me when I was little, and I really admired it. So I think that kind of woman is very appealing to me.
It's so well done what you do with Polly. There are so many scenes in the book with Polly. I have yellow stickies. I mean, I ran out of my little pack. There's so many evocative sentences. And one scene that I think of when I think about Polly is when Polly's husband is watching her at the kitchen sink. And
I love that too.
Oh my gosh, I'm getting a little emotional from that scene. But he's seeing her. You do that so simply and so well. Good heavens, Alice. When does that come to you? When does that hit you as you're writing? I'm fascinated by that.
I really don't know either. It just comes when I'm writing. You know, I'm just writing, sitting here writing along, and it just happens. It doesn't feel as though I'm forcing anything.
Right.
It's a sort of listening. I feel as though I'm listening and then catch things as they go by.
Right.
That's the kind of thing that I just catch.
It's beautiful. The way you describe the light in the kitchen, the sunlight, it's just the whole, my gosh, readers, listeners, when you get to it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Throughout the entire book, there are these like kapow sentences. And I even shared one on Twitter, part of the Sunday sentences thing that I participate in on Twitter. You have this sentence that says, what was the biological purpose of humans having such a vast capacity for denying reality? Which is proof once again of how contemporary Fellowship Point is.
I do wonder that. I wonder every night when I'm watching the news.
And we should put it on a t-shirt, really.
What is the function of that? It doesn't make any sense.
It's unbelievable. Do you have a favorite moment? So I have so many, but those are two that I really wanted to point out for astute observations and so sharp and lovely and gorgeous. Do you have a favorite moment in the book or one that resonates with you?
Hard to pick one.
Yeah, it is.
But
you should talk to Alice Elliott Dark about that. She,
I love the scene that's Polly in the past when she goes to a tea at the house of a friend, and another young woman who's also recently married, this is when Polly's recently married, just has a total freak out. And it's like, what did I do? I don't even know this person. And I really just love that scene. And I love reading it at readings because it just is so, it comes alive for me and it seems so real. And that's the moment when you really see Polly decide her life, because she sort of toys with that. Dick's a little, I can see him this way, the way she sees her husband. But then she decides at the end of that whole scene, I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to be in the marriage. I'm not going to let myself break down like that. I'm just doing it. And she just does. She goes forward from there. She knows who he is. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have illusions. She has hopes that she can get under the surface a little more. But she knows his way of denying reality. She's quite aware, but she wants to back him up.
There's an expression people use that it's breathtaking, because that scene really took my breath away.
Oh.
Because you know what that other lady is saying. You've heard either people say it, you've experienced it yourself. Boy, are you put us right in that moment. And I thought, like, I gasped for breath a couple of times. And listening to you now, I really want to go back and find every interview where you do a reading of that scene. Now I won't rest till I
think I've only done it in person. Oh. I don't think I've done it on recording.
We'll figure out a way to make that happen. Because you're doing all these events, the book is getting obviously incredible reviews. We've talked about that. It came out on July 5th. I am still thinking about certain scenes from this book. So this promotional train that you're on, where can readers find you and your upcoming events?
I have a website. That's probably the best place to look. It's AliceElliottDark.com. I have a list of events, and I have a book club guide, which I'm going to add the map to, because people who are listening are telling me they don't have an opportunity to refer to the map.
Right.
So I think that's a really good point. So I'm going to put the map, and I'm also going to put a little genealogy chart up there.
Oh,
and
that's a great idea.
Yeah, it is. People haven't said that they got confused, but I just think it'd be fun to have it to see, because I did have all these characters between the founder, William Lee, in 1875, and Agnes. I have all of that material, so it'd be fun to just put it up and show who those people are, even though they don't figure into this story. They might figure into other stories.
If you put in a genealogy along with that map, this really does become a 19th century classic.
I know. It seemed like it would be a little too much for this book, but it's there. It's in my notebooks.
Yeah, I think
I had to do it. I had to figure all that out.
I think it's a great idea. Before I let you go, any book recommendations that you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, I'm reading a few new books right now. Which Side Are You On? By Ryan Lee Wong. He was one of my students at Rutgers. And it's a really fantastic book. Young man goes back to interview his mother about her years as being a political activist, Korean American, and she was very involved in coalition building with a Black friend before the LA riots. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to figure out how he can learn activism in his life and cross-racial. So he's interviewing her and talking to her about her past. And it's very funny and it's very smart. It goes in unexpected directions, but I'm loving that. And then Lucky Turtle by Bill Rohrbach. He's a great writer. It's always a great yarn. His prose is wonderful. And this one is young woman who ends up going to one of those sort of re-education, or I don't even know what they call it, but those wilderness kind of camps, and things happen. So it's it's very exciting and fun and well-written. The other one is another friend of mine whose book just came out, The Complicities by Stacey DeRasmo. That is about a woman who's married to someone like a Bernie Madoff character, and what happens to her after he goes to prison, and how much responsibility she bears for having been married to him. It's called The Complicities because it really interrogates how complicit people in her position are and all of us really, like what we're participating in, what we're not. So those are all fun. And I know all those people and I'm really happy for them with their books. So I'm recommending them.
I will share all of that information on the podcast page. Today's book, Fellowship Point, by today's guest, Alice Elliott Dark, is on shelves everywhere. And if it's not, please place a hold or grab a copy at your local independent bookstore. Fellowship Point is published by Mary Sue Rucci Books. Alice Elliott Dark, I am so honored and I thank you so much for taking the time to join me and the listeners on Merrick Library's Top Shelf Podcast. And I hope you'll come back for whatever comes next.
Carolyn, this was so fun. A true pleasure. I love your enthusiasm. It's contagious. I want to go take a walk, big like 5 mile walk now. I feel so full of energized by you.
Be careful. Watch out. Maybe we don't want ham lurking around in the corners. You'll have to read the book to get the reference.
That's true.
Oh my gosh. All right, listeners, I thank all of you for joining me today. And you remember, you can follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you find most podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website, merricklibrary.org. Special thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmier, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and on to the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.